This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran accuses the U.S. and its Western allies of being behind the recent riots, saying the riots represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. West African leaders agree to create a regional force to tackle terrorism and possible coups and restore constitutional order in member countries. Also in our headlines, thousands march in Morocco's capital in protest at high cost of living and repression amid surging inflation and rising social discontent. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister has accused the United States and some of its Western allies of being behind the recent riots in the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, during an official visit to Serbia, said Washington and its allies have always sought to create turmoil in Iran. He said the recent riots were fomented through foreign interference and represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. He added that one of the goals of Washington through the riots was to get more concessions from Tehran in the negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Amir Abdullahian reiterated that a deal on the JCPOA would be acceptable to Tehran only if it was beneficial to the Iranian nation and durable. The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. The Persian Gulf island of Bahrain is hosting the Israeli president for the first time. That has happened in Bahrain's history. As much as Israel would like to show that its relations with Persian Gulf Arab countries is flourishing, their citizens are vehemently against the normalization of ties and have vowed to never recognize Israel.
Protesters in the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. They're chanting death to Israel. Their reason: the Israeli president Isaac Herzog was visiting the Persian Gulf island, the first Israeli president visiting Bahrain. The day before, protesters carried signs with Herzog's image that said "criminal" and "you are not welcome in Bahrain." Opposition activists launched a campaign on social media, speaking out against normalization with Israel. But why was Herzog visiting Bahrain in the first place? And why was there such opposition to his visit? As for the reason of his visit, it was at the invitation of King Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. It is reported that he will meet with members of the local Jewish community and senior government officials. He will also lead a group of Israeli business people to meet with the Bahraini Economic Development Board. But these things could be done by other officials from Israel. It wouldn't need the Israeli president to make a trip to Bahrain for that, unless there are other reasons for the visit. For starters, Israel needs to maintain a high-profile presence when it comes to its relationship with Persian Gulf Arab leaders. This is crucial for Israel as part of the so-called normalization process. Israel normalized ties with the UAE and Bahrain in 2020 as part of the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The agreement paved the way for the normalization with Morocco months later. But the U.S.-led process has not taken off quite the way the U.S. and Israel intended to. For although the leaders of Israel and UAE and Bahrain may have gotten closer, the population of these Arab countries have displayed anger and animosity towards Israel, as was evidenced in the World Cup in Qatar. The reason for this amount of anger toward Israel is very clear. Palestine and Palestinians.
What is this?
Israel Channel. You don't like us?
We are not welcome here. There is only Palestine.
Israel's continued repression and violation of Palestinian rights throughout the decades has been met with some Arab leaders engaging with Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords. For their citizens, this is unacceptable and a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. It appears that the Abraham Accords have become a substitute for improving the lives of Palestinians.
The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan are the countries that have normalized ties with Israel. Jordan did so prior to the Abraham Accords. At the same time, there are 28 UN members that do not recognize Israel. There are speculations that such normalization of ties may have come with strings attached and as a result of U.S. pressure on these countries.
Bahrain has been experiencing an uprising since the beginning of 2011, although the island itself has seen government opposition due to the marginalization of the Shia population itself. Since the uprising, which has continued until this day, the government has been relentless in violating the rights on a vast number of issues. Torture, illegal detentions, sham trials, and death sentences are just some of the examples of the repression of the Bahrainis. Yet despite these human rights violations, the West, in particular the U.S. and its allies, have turned a blind eye to these violations, just like they have done when it comes to Saudi Arabia. Bahrain saw the so-called normalization as a way of strengthening its close relations with the U.S. and its position in Washington, especially among the pro-Israel community, in order to bolster American support for Bahrain and deflect criticism of the kingdom's human rights record. Bahrain also hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet and U.S. Naval Forces Central Command. As such, it is well aware that the rights of Bahrainis is being violated, yet the U.S. chooses to do nothing about it. Israel is clearly the biggest beneficiary of the Abraham Accords. Israel's military is deepening its cooperation with the militaries of Bahrain and the UAE under the umbrella of the U.S. This was pretty evident when all four held their first naval exercise last November in the Red Sea. This all comes down to Israel further undercutting regional support for the Palestinians. Let's not forget, an American official who helped broker the Abraham Accords admitted that their entire aim was to isolate the Palestinians, to put them on, quote, an island. He said the plan was that if we get everybody around the Palestinians to recognize Israel, then where does that leave the Palestinians? They will have to come because they are on an island. 2 years after the Abraham Accords were signed, this is what it has brought Palestinians. Death, execution style.
Elsewhere, Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a 23-year-old, Omar Manah, was shot at Dehesha refugee camp near Bethlehem this morning. He was repeatedly hit in the chest by live fire. Six others were injured by Israeli fire. The Palestinian factions in the Bethlehem area have declared a general strike and a day of mourning. Israeli forces have been killing Palestinians almost on a daily basis in the occupied West Bank. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in the Palestinian territory so far this year. Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah with more on that story. I want to bring us up to speed on this recent Israeli attack that took place in the Dehesha refugee camp, and also tell us more about the Palestinian response to this.
Well, this time Israeli forces raided the Dehesha refugee camp in Beit Lahem to conduct an arrest campaign. This is according to a statement issued by the Israeli military. The Israeli soldiers stormed a number of houses in a Dehesha refugee camp. Of course, Palestinians have resisted the incursion or the raid of the Israeli forces to a Dehesha refugee camp. Clashes took place between Palestinian youths and Israeli forces. As you have mentioned, 23-year-old Omar Manah was shot and killed during this operation. Six others were wounded as well. And the Israeli forces arrested three Palestinians. Two of them are brothers. The Israeli military accuses those Palestinians who were detained in a Dehesha refugee camp that they are engaged in a number of anti-Israeli activities. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, another raid would have taken place to Jenin area. This time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to arrest Palestinian activist and fighter. He is the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior leader of the jihad movement, and he's also a Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. The Israeli forces said the main aim to Jenin incursion is to arrest the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior official of the jihad movement in northern occupied West Bank.
Thanks a lot, Mona Candil, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, West African leaders have agreed to create a regional force to ensure their security. Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States have decided to establish the regional body to tackle terrorism and possible coups and restore constitutional order in member countries. The regional force will intervene when the need arises to safeguard the security of member states. The modalities of the planned regional force will be considered by defense chiefs in the second half of 2023. Mali, Guinea, and Burkina Faso have all been hit by military coups in the last 2 years. Several countries in the region are also suffering from the spread of terrorism. Thousands of people have filled the streets of Morocco's capital in protests at high cost of living amid growing social discontent in the North African country. It's estimated that around 3,000 people from across Morocco converged on central Rabat for the rally staged by left-wing political and trade union organizations. This is the largest rally in recent months in Morocco, which is grappling with inflation, mostly blamed on surging food prices. In the year to October, consumer prices rose by over 7%, but the economic woes are not the only concerns of Moroccans. During the rally, they decried repression of freedom of expression as well as corruption in the country. They expressed anger over the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel in December 2020. Well, the European Commission chief says the EU must take action to offset distortions made by Washington's new climate and tax laws, a move that could put European goods at a disadvantage on American soil.
So we must take action to rebalance the playing field where the IRA and other measures create distortions. In other words, we need to do our homework here in Europe, and at the same time, we have to work with the United States to mitigate competitive disadvantages.
In a speech in the Belgian city of Bruges, von der Leyen said the EU should adjust its rules to make it easier for public investments in the transition to climate-friendly technologies. Her remarks are in response to Washington's Inflation Reduction Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden in August. The act is designed to promote U.S. manufactured goods and accelerate the transition to a low-carbon economy. Some European governments are alarmed by the laws that allow over $400 billion of subsidies for U.S. manufactured goods. They say the act is a threat to their industries, especially in the energy and auto sectors. And the OPEC Plus group of countries has agreed to maintain their current oil output levels. The decision comes in a climate of uncertainty ahead of fresh Western oil sanctions against Moscow. The group comprising OPEC members plus 10 other oil producers decided to stick to their production cut of 2 million barrels per day until the end of next year. The alliance said that it was ready to take immediate additional measures to address market developments if necessary. This after the EU and G7 agreed a $60 per barrel price cap on Russian oil, which will come into effect on Monday or soon after. There's also an EU embargo on maritime deliveries of Russian crude oil. Russia has denounced the price cap, threatening to suspend deliveries to any country that adopts the measure. The British government is considering seeking the military's help during planned strikes, including by the National Health Service. The Conservative Party chairman says the government wants minimal disruption to key public services. For months now, Britain has been witnessing back-to-back strikes across different sectors. The action has spread to the health sector, with nurses in England and ambulance workers in England and Wales planning to stop work later this month. Under pressure, the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is reportedly even considering plans to curb the right to strike. Britain's woes are part of the wider economic crisis in Europe. The situation has been triggered by the inflation and surging energy prices that came on the heels of Western sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Well, our correspondent in London, Robert Carter, joined us earlier with more details on the strikes in the UK and how the new government is handling it.
You know, things like inflation are on the rise, cost of living, things are more expensive now, and people in many sectors feel as if their wages are not increasing in order to keep up with inflation, with price demands. So public sectors, especially like the NHS, are basically feeling the real squeeze. Their pockets are being pinched very much so, and they feel that they have been there during the hardest times, like, for example, during the COVID lockdown period, the pandemic. They were serving on the front lines trying to keep people alive during that horrific episode. And what they're essentially rather being rewarded for their dedication and their hard work, they're actually, in their mind, being punished with a lack of support from the government to help get them through this economic crisis, to help basically give them a wage that they can live off of. That's quite frankly it. There are other issues as well, and they're talking about now curbing the rights of people to protest, especially in the public services, because they have a lot of power to shut things down at a time when the government is already trying to push through controversial policies, controversial new laws, controversial new taxes on the horizon, that type of thing. And obviously, if the country just stops working, that proves to be devastating for this new government led by the relatively new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
The volume of arms trade and military services increased in 2021, with American companies accounting for over half of global sales. That's according to the latest report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The report says the total sales of weapons and related services by the top 100 arm manufacturers worldwide stood at nearly $600 billion last year. That was about a 2% increase compared to the previous year. The report also says U.S. companies dominated global arms production, as they made up 40% of the top companies. Despite a growth in production, the report says demand outstripped the global supply due to the COVID pandemic. Now the demand for more arms is rising, reportedly because countries providing Ukraine with weapons are looking to replenish their stockpiles. And the Italian parliament has passed a resolution authorizing the government to continue to help Ukraine, including via military aid, throughout 2023. This, as an increasing number of Italians are advocating for peace negotiations to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
leaders meeting with besieged volunteer forces. On Saturday, 26th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of members of the besieged volunteer forces at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of views expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Saturday, 26th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of members of the besieged volunteer forces in Tehran. The leader greeted the besieged volunteer forces by saying, "Welcome, my dear brothers and sisters. You are the young, brave members of the besieged. You have illuminated our Hosseiniyah with the besieged spirit that exists within you. Praise God. I would like to congratulate you and all the people of Iran on the occasion of Besieged Week." The Besieged was one of Imam Khomeini's greatest initiatives. He announced the establishment of an army of 20 million in the country in his famous speech in November of 1979. Besieged volunteer forces were established in 1979 after Imam Khomeini's announcement. The blessings of the Besieged and this great initiative were so great that Imam Khomeini delivered that outstanding, eloquent speech in praise of the besieged volunteer forces in November of 1988. I will quote a few of Imam Khomeini's eloquent sentences so that you may remember that our dear Imam addressed the besieged in that speech in the same way that a father would express his love for his children. The Imam said, "The besieged are a school of love and an academy of anonymous martyrs who chanted the call to martyrdom and bravery from its lofty minarets. This is splendid discourse, what excellent phrases," the Imam said. "The besieged are a fruitful tree whose blossoms spread the aroma of springs joining together, the freshness of certainty and the story of love." Imam Khomeini went on to say, "I take pride in being a besieged myself. I would like to kiss the hand of every single one of you." These were the truly unforgettable words of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. You, members of the besieged today, are being addressed by this statement. Imam Khomeini did not say the besieged of the 1980s. He said members of the besieged. You and all future generations were being addressed by the late Imam. May God bless his soul. In further remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "In his statement of November 1988, Imam Khomeini announced the importance of establishing a besieged for university and seminary students. There is a special meaning behind this. He told the university students and the students of religious sciences to have besieged groups and to be mobilized. This means that besieged is not just a military organization and that besieged should be present in all fields, including in sciences and in religious studies." The leader went on to ask, "What is besieged?" "Besieged is a culture, it is a discourse. Besieged is a way of thinking. What is this way of thinking? What is this culture?" "This culture means serving society and the country without any pretense or expectations. This is very important. It means serving without any expectations, without waiting to be praised, and in many cases, without receiving any funds or provisions to do something. After all, every movement requires provisions, but they enter various fields without such things, They serve selflessly and accept the risk of their service in the path of the Almighty. This is the Basiji culture. But what is the meaning of Basiji culture? It means going into mud up to your knees to remove the mud from houses that have been flooded. It means putting yourself at risk of getting infected with COVID and risking your own life to save the lives of people suffering from COVID. Basiji culture means never getting tired when helping others. Basijis do not wait for others to praise them and to say well done. They provide this valuable service throughout the country. The Basijis have been successful in science, research and the laboratories. These were young people who worked in the fields of science and research, and there were those who had Basiji spirit or worked in laboratories, whether it was for COVID or for other issues. Our nuclear martyrs are an example of this. They were Basijis. Another example is the late Dr. Said Kazemi, who established the Royan Research Institute for Stem Cell Research and Genetics Research. This is the culture of the Basij. When facing the enemies on the battlefield, they are fearless. The Basiji culture is one that has been built by self-effacing, hard-working volunteers, as stated by the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. It is a culture of humble, undaunted fighters. It is about serving all the people. It is about serving the country. It means making sacrifices for others and even being oppressed in order to save the oppressed. Turning to recent events in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "You saw how in recent events in the country, the Basijis were the ones being oppressed while protecting the Iranian people from oppression of a group of rioters who were either unaware, misled, misguided, or foreign mercenaries. Basijis stop the oppression of others. They do not allow themselves to become despondent. This is an important quality of Basiji culture. Despair has no meaning for someone who is part of the Basij. Praise God, we have millions of official Basiji forces and millions more who are unofficial volunteers. That is, there are the young people in mosques, universities, associations, schools and other places who do the same things as the Basij and are in fact Basijis, but they're not official members of the Basij organization. Alongside the Basij phenomena in our country, we have the Basij in the Muslim world. There are millions of Basijis in the Islamic world. They are Basij who do not understand our language, nor do we understand their language, but we share the same heartfelt values. These are also the blessings of the Basij." In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "This is Imam Khomeini's legacy, which remains today, and God willing, it will continue to be with us tomorrow, and the country will see its fruits." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, introduced the Basij as a manifestation of the Shajaratul Tayyaba, or the good tree, which has also been mentioned in the Holy Quran. "Have you seen how Allah has drawn a parable? A good principle is like a good tree. Its roots are steady and its branches are in the sky. It gives its fruit every season by the leave of its Lord. The nature of a good tree is that it produces its sweet fruit and gives results in every season. We already spoke about how the Basij have the potential to move the country forward. I will now talk about some of the achievements of the Basij volunteer forces. First of all, the presence of the Basij in any period indicates that the Islamic revolution is alive. It shows that the revolution is thriving. Much of the dismay of those who are frightened and distressed by the word and the name of the revolution. They do not want the revolution to be mentioned. They express hatred towards the Islamic revolution and they reject it. But the presence of the Basij volunteer forces shows the revolution is very much alive. It's blossoming and it's prospering. So one of the fruits of the Basij presence is that it shows the regeneration and vitality of the Islamic Revolution. The second thing is the spirit that I mentioned, the spirit of jihadi work, without expecting anything in return, without wanting to reveal your name, without being pretentious. This will create rapid progress in the country. Work that is done with the intention of impressing others in a pretentious manner has no beneficial value. Doing jihadi work without having any expectations will move the country forward. This is another example of the fruits of the Basij. Third point is the element of spirituality is prominent in all activities that are taken by the Basij volunteers. And this element of spirituality is very important. In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The Basij hold a very important position in the political geography of the Islamic world, which I need to briefly explain. Of course, intellectuals, clear-sighted individuals, and you young people should focus on and think about these issues. Western colonialism has a certain line of approach towards this special region of ours, the West Asia region, or the region they call the Middle East. Following the two world wars, Western colonialism, Europe first and then the Americans, paid special attention to this region and established a distinct approach towards it. But why? Because it is an important region. The movements of the Western world's industrial wheels is dependent on oil from this region, from the West Asia or Middle East region. The world's main center for oil is here in this region, the region of West Asia. It links the East to the West. It is the region that connects Asia, Europe and Africa. This is the most important issue in terms of its strategic position." In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution commented on recent rioting in Iran and negotiations with the United States. The leader said, "Some people claim they understand politics, but it's really upsetting when you see their analysis in newspapers and in some sections of the social media. They say that in order to put an end to the rioting that has been taking place in this country for the past few weeks, you need to solve your problems with the United States first." Now, this is said by those who claim to know about politics and world affairs. They certainly state that you need to solve your problems with America, or they say you should listen to the voice of the people. I have seen these two comments in their writings. Solve your problems with the United States and listen to the voice of the people. But how can the problem with the United States be solved? This is the real question, and it is a very serious question. We do not want to argue with each other. We are asking a question. How can the problem with the United States be solved? Will the problem be solved by sitting down and negotiating and getting a promise from them? If we sit down and negotiate with the United States and make them commit to doing this or that, will the problem be solved? In further remarks, the leader said, "They tell us to stop our nuclear activities. They start by telling us to stop 20% uranium enrichment. Then they tell us to stop 5% uranium enrichment. Next, they tell us to completely halt all kinds of nuclear activities. Then, they will tell us to change the constitution of our country and to remove the Guardian Council. The US is demanding payoffs. If you want to fix your problem with the United States, you must continually surrender to US demands. This is what the Americans really want. Imprison yourself behind your borders, disarm yourselves and shut down your defense industries. What kind of proud, devoted Iranian is willing to give in to those demands?" In concluding remarks, the leader wished success and strength for all members of the Basij volunteer forces, saying, "The final victory would be ours."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this programme we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the dual policy of the Indian government towards religious minorities and the Hindu nationalist BJP party's focus on the so-called Pasmanda, or backward Muslims, ahead of civil body polls in Uttar Pradesh state. And we shall also look at the power crisis in Bangladesh and its strategic implications for the fastest-growing economy in the South Asian region.
Ironically, Indian Muslims have been facing some of the daunting challenges in their country, being ruled by the Hindu nationalist BJP party at the centre and in the majority of provinces. But the BJP government has decided to take the Muslim question not from the top, but from the bottom, meaning those who are worse than low-caste Hindus, such as Dalits, tribals and other backward classes or OBCs. Some observers believe the party at the helm is pursuing a strategy to target the Pasmandas, the most socio-economically oppressed class of Indian Muslims. Earlier this year, Prime Minister Narendra Modi asked his party leaders to reach out to downtrodden sections of communities other than Hindus. Modi's call for economic and social empowerment to the communities, including backward Muslims, surprised both the critics and Hindutva forces who want India to be declared a Hindu state.
The caste system and Asian hierarchical order based on one's birth is nothing but a disease that has plagued not only the Indian Hindu society, but South Asia as a whole. Despite regional and cultural variations, caste is a common feature among all religious communities in this region and plays a pivotal role in the distribution and control of knowledge, power, property, resources, sexuality, and dignity. Indian Muslims do not have caste hierarchy, but they too are victims of stratification based on their professions and are divided into three main classes and hundreds of subclasses. At the top are the Ashraf Muslims, namely Sayyid, Sheikh and Khan, who trace their origin either to Western or Central Asia. Sayyid is highly revered and in status is almost symmetrical to Brahmins in Hinduism. Ajlaf, that means backward, and Arzal, as Dalit Muslims are collectively known as the Pasmanda, a Persian word meaning left behind. It is a term used for other backward classes. Leaders of backward Muslims claim that nearly 85% of the Muslim population in India is Pasmanda and only 15% belong to pay orders. The community has often tried to raise the issue of its socioeconomic backwardness and cited the numerical majority among the Muslim. Still, a tiny elite section, Ashrafs, remain in the lead position. They claim that out of the roughly 400 Muslims elected in the first 14 lower house of parliament, only 60 were from the Pasmanda background.
Muslims have gone to some lengths to perpetuate the myth of a casteless or classless community. But facts remain on the ground as the same notion has now come to haunt them as they struggle to push their claim for reservation enshrined in the Indian constitution for the victims of the centuries-old Hindu caste system. The renewed debate on reservations spurred with the introduction of a 10% quota for economically weaker sections has led Muslims to revive their long-lasting demand for a share of the pie, arguing that theirs is amongst the economically most backward communities and therefore eligible to be included in the list.
After the recent victories in the state assembly elections, the BJP has intensified its groundwork to grab most votes in the civic elections. Political parties in Uttar Pradesh are all gearing up for urban local body polls in December. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in the state is planning a new experiment in these elections, which are being seen as the semi-finals for the 2024 parliamentary elections. The BJP, popularly known as Saffron Party, is said to have recruited thousands of Muslim leaders and activists from different class-based groups to help it with campaigning. They are going all out to win over Muslim voters, especially those categorized as the Pasmanda. A BJP source says there are 27 assembly segments in Gujarat where Muslim voters have a significant impact on the election outcome. The party, therefore, has concentrated its strategy on these assembly segments by using Muslim community leaders and workers to conduct door-to-door campaigning in Muslim-dominated neighborhoods. A party source says their task is to inform Muslim voters about the welfare schemes launched for them by the BJP government. The Muslim leaders are also attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party, which has so far been seen as anti-Muslim and hate-monger.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Razvi. He's a political commentator from London. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Razvi. Now, after the big victory in the assembly elections, the BJP has now intensified its attempts with the civic elections. So what is the importance of this election for BJP and other parties?
BJP has been in power for the last 8 years, and they're hoping to sort of continue in power for the next 4 years when the general elections come up shortly. The situation is, what you've got to look at is really well documented in what is called the Gujarat Files, anatomy of a cover-up by a famous Muslim journalist in India called Rana Ayub. And she really sort of shows how Narendra Modi and Amit Shah ascended in power and their journey from Gujarat to New Delhi. What they did back in the early 2000s, when there were huge massacre and program of Muslim killing in Gujarat. So they've used that as a template from Gujarat to really occupy the power, the central power in New Delhi. And they're using that, as I said, as a template to motivate the Hindu majority on a very sort of religious basis. And their former two victories have been basically, essentially based on that particular approach of dividing the Indian population into Hindus and Muslims.
So, Mr. Razvi, while the BJP government tries to woo Pasmanda or backward Muslims by welfare schemes, the Muslim leaders are attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party itself. So what are the roots of these doubts amongst the Muslim community?
But what you've got to look at is that Pasmanda Muslims, as I said, Indian society is a very caste-ridden society. You have the ruling elite, which comes from the Brahmin caste, which is perhaps 1%, 2% of the Hindu population. Then you've got many stratas of Hindus who are lower caste or what are known as Harijans, the untouchables. Then you have what is, interestingly called the other backward class or classes, in which Pasmanda Muslims are also included, because they are, by definition, not in the Hindu caste system because they're Muslims, but also because they have been impoverished, poor, and sort of in occupations which are seen as to be demeaning for ordinary other people. So effectively, 51, for example, in a state like Bihar, which is in the eastern part of India, over 50% of the population is deemed to be other backward classes, which includes Hindus and Muslims. So it's a sort of a very complex political voting bank structure, if you like. In the past, the Congress Party, which used to rule India for the good 30 years after the partition in 1947, also relied on the Muslim vote. So what the BJP is now trying to do, I suspect, is trying to vow these Pasmanda Muslims from the poor and the lower classes to vote for them, because they've been offering them certain incentives and other benefits, which could sort of give BJP that leverage in getting the Muslim vote as well from these particularly deprived classes in India.
Mr. Razvi, like you said, in the 1990s, we saw the rise of several social movements that gave voice to and a new direction to abolish class or caste-based hierarchy in the Muslim society. So the question is, why have these movements become faint and silent today?
It's an interesting question. Effectively, in Islam or in Muslims, there is supposed to be no caste system. However, there are elitist Muslims, well-off Muslims, educated Muslims up and down the country, from north to the south, east to the west. As you know, India is a huge country with a population of about 1.4 billion. So in that, you would have some wealthy Muslims. What has happened, sadly, if you like, is that some of the very wealthy Muslims themselves, whether they live in New Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, Calcutta, they have tended to actually turn a blind eye to their own Muslim brethren at times.
Before we let you go, sir, the BJP government has decided to enter the Muslim question not from the top but from the bottom, through Dalits, OBCs and tribals. So what are the effects of this strategy on the unity of Muslims in India?
Well, that's a very difficult question. One would have to really see what happens at the elections, but I'm sure they will make some inroads into the poorer community, because, as I said, the other backward classes, the OBCs, if you like, and Muslims, some of the poorer Muslims fall in that category. Therefore, the incentives and the sweetness that are being offered to poorer Muslims, if you like, will sway some of them to vote. But I think the strategy in the medium to long term, but in the short term, it may be effective, but I think medium to long term, the Muslim political elite will realize that it's in their interest also to be working together with their less well-off Muslim brethren, Muslim community, so that they are not swayed by BJP at this moment.
There you have it, Mr. Shabir Razvi, a political commentator from London. It's always good to have you with us, Mr. Razvi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Relatively orderly posted, Rajnath Singh reaches out to Muslims, says BJP ready to apologize for past mistakes. Pallavi Ghosh says, will Muslims vote for the BJP in 2024 as BJP reaches out to them?
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In early October, Bangladesh suffered from a grid failure that triggered a blackout across 75 to 80% of the country. This latest development is a mere indicator of the looming power crisis in Bangladesh, where long power cuts and load shedding have become common occurrences. The intermittent electricity supply has impacted key export industries, which are crucial for bringing in much-needed foreign exchange. This crisis also threatens to push Bangladesh into a cycle where it will be unable to secure enough energy imports due to a shortage of foreign reserves, having long-standing strategic implications with its energy partners.
A combination of global and domestic factors has led Bangladesh to the present crisis. Close to 85% of the nation's electricity is generated using fossil fuel like natural gas and oil, with the former being the primary source. An exponential rise in oil and gas prices due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the decision by the OPEC Plus to reduce oil output, and the European Union's sanctions on the Russian energy sector has resulted in surging inflation and unsustainable energy import bills. Thus, Bangladesh has also been compelled to stop gas purchases and shut down its several diesel-run power plants. Dhaka's scant attention to renewable energy and policies like capacity payments has exacerbated the energy crisis there. Until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest-growing economy in the region. A core part of its success has been the ready-made garments industry, which makes up more than 10% of its GDP and employs around 4.5 million people. Today, Bangladesh is the world's second-largest garments exporter, and the RMG sector accounts for 84% of its exports, playing a crucial role in the country's foreign reserves. However, the current crisis has slowed down the industry, with many factories reporting a fall-off in production by 50%. Daily power outages lasting around 3 hours on average have been one of the main contributors to this trend.
For Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. Each of its key energy partners comes with a caveat. With Russia, it's the possibility of further attracting Western pressure, unpredictability, and rising costs of doing business. Reliance on China raises questions about reliability and unsustainable debt, and also disrupts the brewing relationship with India and the US. Undoubtedly, the US comes with expertise and financial capabilities, but lacks commitments, and therefore is not yet capable of countering Russian and Chinese cooperation with Dhaka. Finally, despite technical and financial limitations, India comes with the potential for energy connectivity and trade.
Dhaka faces an uphill task of securing additional gas supplies, rapidly diversifying electricity mix to meet its green energy pledges, and continuing the dynamic economic growth. Shift towards prioritizing long-term energy security requires a careful balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another. China and Russia have traditionally been vital partners for Bangladesh's energy sector. Today, 90% of the energy projects in Bangladesh's pipeline are funded by China. On the other hand, Moscow has helped Bangladesh with gas exploration and drilling. It has also extended nuclear cooperation by building Bangladesh's first power plant. China and Russia's increasing energy cooperation with Dhaka have compelled the United States to step up its cooperation to be a credible energy partner for Dhaka and counter its reliance on Russia and China. Acknowledging the growing extra-regional footprint in Bangladesh, India is also ramping up its energy cooperation with Dhaka. Revitalized dialogue channels within Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, and Nepal for regional cooperation in energy can provide Bangladesh access to cheap and clean energy from Nepal and Bhutan as well. This cooperation allows Bangladesh a long-term solution for its growing power demand and could help reduce its reliance on fossil fuels by tapping the vast hydropower potential of the neighboring Himalayan nations.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed. He's a director for Center for Muslim Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, for Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. How can Dhaka use the situation, balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another?
Yeah, I think the issue that Bangladesh has is a short-term and a long-term one. And, you know, that in the short term, like in other parts of the world, the energy crisis is going to be very difficult and challenging, as you say, to deal with. Because of the increase in prices, the capacity of Bangladesh has been really the fact that they don't have enough reserves to pay for the extra cost rise that's taken place around the world. And they've been dependent on mainly Russia and China for their gas and Qatar for their needs, both petrol and also the gas mainly. And this has meant that